Good afternoon. I call this meeting of Human Services Finance Committee to order. Members, we have quorum present. With that, I would like to request the approval for the minutes of March 9, 2023. Representative Kaur, do you move the approval for the minutes of March?
I will do so, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kaur moved the approval for March 9, 2023 minutes. Any discussions? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? See none. The minutes for March 9, 2023 are now approved. With that, we've got a couple of bills before us today. We will start with House File 1067. Representative Hansen, I will move that House File 1067 be re-referred to Ways and Means Committee. Please introduce the bill and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noren. Thank you, committee members. House File 1067 is a bill that was before you already this year. We have now gotten the fiscal note, which should be included in your information. And so just as a reminder, House File 1067 is the bill that seeks to allow PCAs to drive their clients and to be sure the agencies are reimbursed for those costs. I don't have any testifiers here with me, but if you'll remember Jeff Bangsberg Jillian was here with me as well, just to make sure that we can kind of refresh our memories on what that bill was. So I won't take up much time with this, but I will turn it back to you, Chair, and can answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. We had the discussion on this bill on February 14th. I just wanted to check with the fiscal staff, Mr. Bag. We do have a fiscal note for this bill, and wanted to check with you. Yes.
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct. In your packet, there's a fiscal note for this bill. It shows a total cost of $1.7 million, $1,529,000 in fiscal 24 and $159,000 in fiscal 25. Again, this only has to cover the period from when the bill is enacted until the start of CFSS, which under CFSS, driving is covered allowable service.
Mm-hmm. With that, Representative Hassan, I think the intent here is we have right now under the federal health emergency, we continue to provide that service, which we anticipate is going to end May 11, 2023. Any discussion, then?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it just seems like when we had your testifiers and the discussions, it seems like there would be places where we're actually saving money by doing this more efficiently. And is that something that we can actually see reflected? Or is it like, no, those costs? So I guess, you know, if we can just have that mental note, that asterisk saying that, you know, I think that there is actually more behind this and that the value of this is more than, or more, perhaps not exactly. This cost does not actually reflect everything that we would be getting out of making the change. So thanks for the fiscal note and the explanation of it.
Representative Lesney.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Representative. I'm just thrilled to see this bill.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to help healthcare across the state. And so I think this is a great bipartisan bill and appreciate you bringing it forward. So thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other member discussion? Hearing none, I think this is a good bill, and we need to take appropriate action. Hopefully, it can be on the consent agenda item so we can quickly pick it up. With that, your closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, committee members. And so I appreciate you letting me come back with the fiscal note. And the further path of this reflects the bipartisan conversation that we had with the desire to get this bill to the floor and making sure that we can get this done sooner than later, considering the time that it will take to fully implement this. So I just really appreciate everyone moving this quickly with me.
I'll renew my motion that House File 1067 be re-referred to Ways and Means Committee. Will all those in favor please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, the motion prevails, and you're on your way to Ways and Means. The second bill is House File 1512. Representative Hansen, can you explain the bill, or I will I will move the House File 1512 be re-referred to the General Register. Mm-hmm.
And I do have an A1 amendment, Chair.
An A1 amendment. I will move your A1 amendment. Discussion on the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Chair. This gets the bill into the shape that we would like. In the last committee at policy, there were some questions just to clarify some of the language. And so this is the result of those follow-up conversations to be sure this is very clear in the intent and the practice of this bill. Gets it in the shape that I would like.
All those in favor of A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, the amendment is now adopted. To your bill as amended, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Nora and committee members. As amended, House File 1512 allows people with compromised immune systems to remotely receive some of their PCA services to avoid unnecessary health risks. This bill will prevent additional agency workers from having to visit their PCA's home and can remotely conduct visits instead. Specifically, this bill will address the services provided by QPs, or qualified professionals. Qualified professionals are employed by the PCA agency, and their role is to provide training, supervision, and evaluation of the agency's PCA services. These are nurses, social workers, mental health practitioners, and qualified designated coordinators. They evaluate the effectiveness of PCA services. They meet with clients 2 to 4 times per year, and they are not the providers providing the hands-on or day-to-day services per se. Members, PCA services are foundational to meeting the needs of a diverse population of some of Minnesotans' most vulnerable citizens. Over 44,000 people are receiving PCA services in Minnesota with the goal to live as independently as possible in their communities. The PCA program is the most diverse home and community-based service with 63% of recipients identifying as Black, Indigenous, Latinx, African, Asian, or are as a person of color. Many PCA recipients live on low incomes, many live in multi-generational households, and many are facing disproportionate impacts of viral infections like COVID-19, the flu, RSV, and other public health risks. Communicable diseases are a very real threat to the lives of people with disabilities in this community. This bill feels like a common sense approach to avoid exposing vulnerable people to unnecessary health risks and allowing them to receive these services remotely. This is not a blanket change for all PCA services, nor is it for all recipients. And PCA agencies do not get the option to opt out of in-person visits. Remote visits need to be at the request of the service recipient. They must be approved by their healthcare provider, and they must be documented by the agency. The goal of this bill is to be sure that the most vulnerable PCA recipients are allowed to receive remote qualified professional visits while also creating safeguards for program integrity. And with that, Chair, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Knorr and committee, my name is Noelle Dohmeyer. I work as a qualified professional, or QP, for Best Care. It's a PCA 245D and financial management service provider. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for authoring it. Per statute, during a supervisory visit, a qualified professional must evaluate the satisfaction of services, review the service recipient's month-to-month plan of hours, review the documentation, document changes, and to their care plan, review its goals and the PCA's performance. QPs are required to complete an initial in-home visit as well as an annual in-home visit. The frequency of additional visits is dependent on the service that client has chosen. For example, there are a minimum of 2 visits required each year for PCA Choice, and 4 visits are required for PCA Traditional. More visits can be provided on the needs of that client or their supervisory PCA needs. So why is this bill needed? We believe this bill would allow us to practice a person-centered approach for people with a compromised immune system. It aims to decrease the client's risk of contracting a potentially life-threatening illness. It would empower clients with a compromised immune system to receive their services in a way that helps keep them safe while being able to maintain their services without punitive action due to not complying with the home visits. While most people have resumed normal life after COVID, many people with compromised immune systems still live in fear of contracting the illness. I currently have a caseload of 136 clients. I am Best Care's Spanish interpreter, and 37 of my clients speak only Spanish. I work very hard to develop relationships with my clients beyond their required visits. Some I have known for more than 7 years. On any given day, I may have up to 5 scheduled in-home visits going from home to home, which could put my immune-compromised clients at risk. Allow me to provide a few real-life examples of just 2 of my clients who have requested that I do not come to their home. A 31-year-old woman with a compromised immune system who's frequently hospitalized. She lives in a 2-bedroom apartment with 3 generations, including her grandmother, who's currently receiving treatment for stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Another client I serve is an elder woman at the end of her life battling a terminal illness. We saw during COVID in the peacetime emergency, when visits were allowed to be performed remotely, that QPs were able to meet the DHS guidelines by providing training and supervision and evaluation of their services through a mix of in-person visits and telehealth. We believe QPs are experts in their field and can fulfill the required duties with excellence even by a video call. We also believe we can continue to capably access the health and safety needs of our clients in a way that's dignified manner while giving the clients a choice to direct their services in a way that works best for them. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and please support House File 1512.
Is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill in the public? Seeing none, member discussions, Representative Zelesnik.
Thank you, Chair Noor and Representative Hansen. I can see that there's many situations like you outlined where a client may not be able to go out. I mean, we know what happens in snowstorms. We've had a lot of them this year. And mobility, and then immunocompromised. There's so many pieces for people that need PCA services, seniors in all ages. But, you know, many times it's even as the anxieties that come with, you know, toileting needs, and they're set up in their home to be comfortable with that. And so I'm happy to see that we're doing some of this for supervision when it makes sense for the providers to have that flexibility, because I think it's the best use of resources, and clients aren't going to be waiting for services, and they're not going to have to go through so many barriers that are just not necessary when we have the technology to do it. And there's a time to be seen in person for acute changes and things like that. But routine supervisory visits, when you can review medical documentation, medication pass, goals, needs, all those types of things, can be done in other ways. So I'm glad to see we're moving that way for our clients, for our patients, to make healthcare better. And I don't see this as a big cost saving. I think if anything, it's probably just going to save in mileage, because every professional I see in healthcare, there's a tremendous amount of documentation that is required from licensed professionals to assure that the program goals are being met. So I'm wondering if that's your assessment, that the big cost saving is just going to be transportation mileage. If you could answer that. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Zeleznikar. I would agree with you that we do have a fiscal note requested, but there isn't a dollar-to-dollar, and our fiscal notes oftentimes don't reflect cost savings. I'm looking at Doug Berg just to make sure. Sometimes they do. But also, I would just highlight that this saves lives, too, and that is priceless.
So just wanted to clarify, there's no cost associated with this bill. That's why it's going to the General Register.
Yeah.
The savings will be most likely to the agency providing because of the effectiveness and also the work that will be done.
Right.
So that's why there's no fiscal note of this bill. Chair Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question that I have is just to understand, to make sure, it seems like this is a really good idea, and that maybe it should be the norm rather than that sense of this is the exception, because there is, it's not just mileage, the cost of the car and the gas and things like that, but the person's time as we think about our workforce and how we get a scarce resources, which is what we're talking about, these professionals, how we get that across a larger population of people in an effective way, is there, you know, that to me seems like this would be something that we should essentially be removing that barrier of saying it can be done this way. And I don't know if it's, does it, which is, I suppose we're not saying it ought to be done this way. We're just saying it can be done this way right now. And is there any barrier to have it be rolled out in ways that, is there any barriers right now with the way the bill is written that there will be some reluctance to adopt this as an alternative?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Pryor. Right now, we want to make sure that we're addressing the immediate need ahead of us, which is to address the folks who have compromised immune systems. I am 1,000% interested in expanding the availability of options of services to more people in Minnesota in a more timely manner and a more cost-effective manner, and also in a manner that reflects the extreme workloads that we have on our existing workforce. As you know, I work in a lot of things about helping to address the workforce issues, specifically in the helping fields and professions. And so I think we should collaborate and talk with some of my advocates on pursuing that in a separate case. Absolutely.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Maybe a question to the testifier, Noel, and again, thank you for what you do. I love the idea of this. I think this is, it makes a lot of sense, just from a timing standpoint, from a workforce, gives us a little bit more wiggle room, you know, for mm-hmm. the folks that are requesting this. I know there's folks are going to have to check it off as well. It isn't just a single decision. Mm-hmm. What I worry about, because I've never done a ride along with your mm-hmm. industry before, and I've learned so much by doing those kind of things, is what do you also see in a home, you know, when you do visit? So I think of things that, like, you know, if it ends up and they've been around for a couple years, and you really just then, I think it sounds like we're just going to do a one annual visit in person. A lot can happen in 12 months, I guess, if this went forward. Do you worry about things like hygiene and bacteria in the refrigerator? I'm not sure you're doing all those things anyway, but what is there anything that makes you just pause for just a second to go, this might be something that we might have to address, because you're in it all the time? Is there mm-hmm. anything like that we should be worried about?
Chair Baker, that's a really good question, because it allows me to reiterate that the additional visits can be made. Keep in mind, with the traditional PCA choice, there are 4 visits required per year, and they're alternating right now home, phone, or which is video and audio. So we are seeing the client to see how they present themselves. And after doing this for so many years and getting to know clients, you can kind of get a feel for how they're doing. The other part of that is I have to supervise PCAs. PCAs are mandated reporters. If there's a condition that they feel that client is being neglected, even it's a neglect of self, they're mandated to report it to us. We do reiterate that to them. I can't, you know, see that for myself, but I can also, there's lots of clients that do want to have home visits when it's not scheduled, and there's supervisory time for that, so I could do that in using my precautions, knowing that I've seen other people that day. Also, if a PCA, if a client has a medical change of condition or comes home from the hospital and that care plan needs to be updated, I may need to go to that home to physically train that PCA on a new G-tube or on a trach or on oxygen. That's an opportunity for me to assess how that client's doing, to realize that, well, you didn't have a walker before, you look as if that you're at risk for falls now, let's give you some resources and refer you. So when there's a change of medical condition that would change that client's PCA care plan, I'm made aware of that, and then I can assess that and go to their home to physically see. If they have a responsible party change, it's another opportunity for me to go over all of those safety measures. So there's lots of opportunity throughout that year.
Mr. Chair, perfect. Thank you for that answer. It was very helpful. So when there's maybe a significant health change, again, there's a new condition they have to do, there's maybe a new procedure, would that, as a current person in the field, would that automatically for you, when you're told of the situation, trigger a visit just to make sure? Or if they even didn't want it, you just, now that it's been kind of put on this virtual visit, you can step in, I assume, any time to still do this. But should we have anything different in the language than to kind of address your authority, if you will, to make sure that you have that ability to do that? Because I wouldn't want somebody to say, no, stay away, I'm fine. I want to make sure that we don't leave anybody out. That's all.
Chair Baker, excuse me. I appreciate that, because that brings to my attention, too, that if there is a change of medical condition, and an common example is a client's having a stroke due to their prior diagnosis and coming home and needing a change in their care plan, which is my job to request an early reassessment, I need to go to the home to assess their condition now that you've had that stroke, post-stroke, and I need to go over that with your PCA. So that's an additional one. Thank you.
And to that, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Hansen, again, I love the bill. I just want to make sure we capture those kind of thoughts about mm-hmm. any kind of changing conditions, and to make sure that we don't, a few years from now, go, we missed something here, because we should have had just a little bit more language. We don't want to have DHS come in here and say this thing is not good because we didn't think about a couple little things. That's mm-hmm. all. So, again, support the bill, but got to think it all through.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker. And I will just say I hear you, and I feel like Representative Edelson brought up similar concerns in policy, and I feel like our amendment really does address a lot of that to make sure. But if there's any specific language that you would like that's going to the General Register, it's moving through the Senate, you know, the next place to amend it would be on the floor, and we can keep in conversation about that. I have a number of advocates who can comment on that, too. But I also want to say this is the importance of care teams, right? Collaborative care matters a lot. And so having licensed professionals, nurses, social workers, whoever that may be there, they have licensing requirements and guidelines, in addition to the PCAs being there on a regular basis, in addition to that client being in touch with their healthcare professional, hopefully that surrounding of care makes sure that we don't miss anything. And with my background in social work, and this is Social Workers Month, I'll just say we social workers are really good at catching all the things. And so if there's any kind of holes in that, you know, it is incumbent on us in the way that we're trained and our values and our ethics to make sure that we are helping that client live as independently, healthily as possible in their communities like they want to be.
Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen, and to their testifier. I will try not to go over too much of the others, because I think actually a number of my questions, concerns actually got addressed. I do want to say thank you to Representative Hansen for really being thoughtful and listening and incorporating the items in the amendment, because I think they make the bill better and certainly add that comfort language, which is really good. Also, we did talk a lot about the staffing issues and how we can make the systems work more efficiently, both for the clients and for the caregivers. So I really appreciate all of those pieces. And, you know, I also share that we want to make sure that we don't miss mm-hmm. any steps, that there are no gaps. I do understand and just want to be clear that we know that PCAs are but one piece in the continuum of care. There are others surrounding mm-hmm. these individuals who also can help with aiding in that, including social workers, who help catch all those pieces. So thank you for the bill. It's a really good bill, and I really appreciate the thought process and the willingness to have that conversation to make it even better.
Do you have any closing remarks?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. I appreciate all the conversation and your support as well. It's really meaningful to me, and I'm looking forward to having a great conversation and a very green board on the floor.
I'll renew my motion that House File 1512 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and you're on your way to General Register. Members, the next bill we have is House File 1695, Chair Nelson. and we move too fast so that we will give him a minute or two. While he is coming up, I think we have 25 seconds. That would be great. So, Executive Director Michelle Weber, if you can join us and just walk us through the Legislative Coordinated Commission report on this bill. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I'm Michelle Weber. I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and we provide staff support to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. All of the negotiated contracts are submitted to that subcommittee for review prior to coming to the full legislature for consideration of ratification. The bill that you have before you has two sections. The first section ratifies the fiscal year 2024-25 agreement with the Service Employees International Union for Direct Support Workers, often referred to as the Personal Care Assistants, or PCAs, for individuals who are disabled or elderly. There are approximately 29,000 providers who are covered by this agreement. The agreement does require two actions by the legislature. It requires ratification of the agreement, which is included in the bill before you, as well as an appropriation to fund the covered costs of the agreement, and that's typically carried through a separate bill. MMB is considered the employer for the purposes of the agreement, and DHS, as a payer of services, is here today as well to answer specific questions that you may have. The agreement increases the minimum hourly wage from $15.25 an hour to $19 on January 1st, 2024, or within 30 calendar days of federal approval of a state plan and waiver amendment. And then it increases the minimum wage to $20 an hour on January 1st, 2025. It also creates a tiered wage structure for PCA Choice, or CFSS, on January 1st, 2025, or within 90 days of federal approval. And that ranges from $20 an hour to $22.50 an hour, depending on the cumulative hours worked since July 1st, 2017. And I will pause there in case you...
You should continue.
I should continue. Okay. All right. Great. Thank you. The agreement also replaces two existing floating holidays with Independence and Veterans Day as paid holidays, and it adds Juneteenth as a holiday in 2024. It creates an orientation committee to design orientation programming and dedicates $500,000 each year for that work. It provides $3 million for stipends to individuals who complete orientation sessions. It permits the parties to create a joint labor management trust fund, with the state providing $1 million for future programs. It increases available funds for $500 training stipends from a current funding amount of $1 million to $2 million. And it also includes a letter of agreement for $1,000 stipends for providers with 6 months of services, and it provides $50 million for those stipends. The overall costs of the agreement are estimated to be $302.7 million in fiscal year 24-25 and $490.6 million in fiscal year 26-27. Section 2 of the bill ratifies two memorandums of understanding. These memorandums of understanding were actually related to the current contract. However, they were recently updated to extend some of the timelines because they were not ratified last legislative session. The first MOU provides $1.4 million for stipends of up to $1,000 for providers who provided services between December 1st, 2020 and February 7th, 2021. It also requires DHS to cooperate with the Department of Labor and Industry when reviewing complaints from providers. The second memorandum of understanding provides $5.6 million for $200 stipends to offset costs for individuals who are using their personal devices to participate in the electronic visit verification program. And it requires DHS to provide training for that. And that concludes an overview of both the agreement and the MOUs.
Thank you so much, Ms. Weber. I would like to welcome Chair Nelson to the Human Services Finance Committee. I will move that House File 1695 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Please introduce the bill to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Weber has probably did an excellent job of explaining the bill and explaining what it is. And this is the fifth agreement that we've had with the SEIU Healthcare Division. And so these are the people, again, the personal care attendants. At the simplest, they're the ones that are hired by the individuals and work in people's homes. And we need the raise in money so that we can attract more people to this. Otherwise, people that can stay in their homes with a little bit of help will have to go to nursing homes or other facilities, which are a lot more costly. And so that's what this bill does. And this is just basically the agreement with the state and with the SEI union.
Great. So there's also an additional testifier who is a personal care attendant, Elaine. Good afternoon and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members of the committee. My name is Ellen Wiederhoft. I live in Minneapolis, and I'm here to testify on behalf of my union, SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. Our union represents over 50,000 healthcare workers across the state, including hospital, clinic, and nursing home employees. I am part of our largest member unit, which covers almost 29,000 self-directed home care workers, including PCAs and family caregivers. 7 years ago, during my last year of college, I began working in home care. I quickly grew to love the adaptability and intimacy that this work requires. Currently, I work as the primary PCA for an amazing 11-year-old named Zoe. She is smart, incredibly strong, and has a huge personality. Zoe also requires assistance with most aspects of her daily life. Like so many people in Minnesota and families, Zoe's family can't find enough workers to cover the open shifts. Our wages are low, turnover rates are high, and benefits like retirement accounts and affordable health care are virtually non-existent. Why would anyone want a job like that? This worker shortage was preventable, but thankfully, there are working solutions to fix it. Our bargaining team won some incredible long-standing member priorities, which will help improve outcomes for home care workers, clients, and their families. With this contract, we raise the wage floor from $15.25 to $19 an hour in 2024 and on to $20 an hour in 2025. We won $1,000 bonuses for PCAs who stay in the workforce for at least 6 months to help retain and attract new home care workers. We created a tiered wage structure to reward home care workers with wage increases that reflect their time in the field. And finally, we ensure continued collaboration between our union and DHS to build an orientation program that prepares new employees for the complexities of home-based care. I do want to address the question on whether DHS has accurately projected the cost of our contract. Since providers first raised concerns about the calculations, our union has encouraged DHS to take the issue seriously and even help set up meetings for further discussion. Our union wants DHS to be accurate. We gain nothing if our contract is underfunded. We're glad DHS made a small adjustment to their cost calculations this year, but we're unsure whether their calculation provides sufficient funding for the full value of the wage increases in our contract. I'll be honest, I've always seen my home care work as a temporary thing. I love this work, but the current working conditions are not sustainable. I need an affordable health care option. I've been the sole contributor to my retirement account for over 10 years. Prior to bargaining this contract, I planned to go back to school to become a nurse. However, with this contract, I just might be able to make my dream of a career in home care a reality. Finally, I want to thank all of the members for hearing this bill to ratify our contract. In the past, we could only do this work with bipartisan support in the legislature. This is a life-changing contract for thousands of Minnesotans, caregivers, and recipients, and we deserve it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Whitehouse, for your testimony and the work that you do. We really appreciate it. We thank you for the work that you do every day. We have member discussions. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if this is a question for Ms. Weber or maybe the author of the bill, but it's regarding my history with MMB through the Opioid Council and how challenging it can be sometimes to ever wiggle around MMB. Their rules are hard and they're firm, and their language sometimes gets interpreted differently by their agents. It's a different thing, but and we're not going to dive into that far. But my question might be, if your contract here, that I have no problem supporting the contract and what's happening here, but what about these new possible mandates coming our way? They start in 24, 25, like let's say the earned sick and safe time or the paid family leave time. Those are things that MMB are going to ask themselves, are we legally able to change their contracts with this coming their way? How will this possibly affect if we pass legislation, Representative Nelson, on that issue? Has that question been asked to MMB or to DHS, and how will that affect the contracts that are being kind of ratified? But with this moving forward, how will that tie into this?
Chair Nelson, I'll just begin with that. I think the discussion about paid family medical leave, unsafe and sick time, it's something that we are considering. This is the Committee of Jurisdiction. When we approve this contract, to make sure that we fully fund and ensure that we have the resources that will help the providers, whether they are choice or traditional. And that is our intent, to look into some of the costs and to be able to include it in our bill. But I think for this contract, it ratifies the agreement with SEIU, and that just provides us the floor. It's not the ceiling. Chair Nelson, did you want to add anything?
I was going to say that They would have to be bound if those do pass and become law. They would have to be bound by that, but that wouldn't affect this contract as far as the pay. This is basically the pay and working conditions that they're at right now, and it's improving those. It wouldn't affect that if the state requires paid days off and those things that are in those agreements, which I don't, those aren't my bills, so I'm not fully aware of all the intricacies of that. But MMB would have to work that out. And again, this bill, this covers the people that are self-directed, but the extra money, the increase in pay also goes to the people that work for agencies. But what this contract with the ones that are self-directed through SEIU, the money goes to the employees, where the ones that are going to the agencies, it goes to the agencies, and it may or may not get down to the employees.
Mr. Chair, and again, I'm not trying to trip anybody up here. I guess I'm just asking the question because the contracts that we're approving today will fiscally affect us in fiscal year 24, 25, and 26, 27, right? So the bills that we're considering, and I know they're not in front of us today, that's not what we're trying to do. I'm kind of asking the question maybe either to MMB or to Ms. Weber or to somebody who just, what if this does pass? Does MMB then have the legal authority to exercise that extra fiscal cost that we are not approving today? That's kind of what I'm trying to get to, is just when these things start moving out, what happens then to those agencies that have to make that actual decision about things that we have not given them approval for? So I'm not sure where the question should be asked, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair, this contract is a two-year contract. As we always do with our fiscal notes, is we project out beyond this year. This contract runs, and maybe Ms. Weber can the exact dates, but this contract doesn't run into the 26-27 biennium. Those are just the projected costs that they have. So those could change in 26-27 when we're in that legislative budget cycle. This is for this budget cycle.
Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Baker, Representative Nelson is correct. This current agreement that's before you today is for July 1st, 2023 through June 30th of 2025. for fiscal year 24-25. That's the term of the agreement. There are some provisions, like safe and sick time, that might already be included in negotiated contracts that that MMB has entered into with various bargaining agreements. And the laws that are being passed might already be covered in the agreement. So it would be really specific to the particular bill and what new benefits might be being provided through the bill that's being considered. Each contract is negotiated every 2 years, so that would enter into effect at that time as well.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just the final. And I appreciate that. I guess I just want to maybe again to Ms. Weber, does MMB, when they're sitting there with you, I assume either in the negotiating process, I'm not sure if you're actually at the table or going through all that process, but are these things that are being considered now part of maybe some future considerations when they're looking at rates of pay and everything else and benefits that we know our state employees need to be taken care of? Are we starting to see some conversations happening at those levels right now that are maybe coming up for future contracts?
Mr. Chair and Representative Baker, I work with the Legislative Coordinating Commission here at the legislature. We are not privy to the and don't sit at the negotiation table when those conversations are occurring. And it's my understanding that MMB does not have somebody currently here today. Okay. So that might be a follow-up.
I think we have someone from the Department of Human Services. So Erica Bailey is coming down. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Baker and committee members. I'm Elise Bailey, Budget Director for the Department of Human Services. So the current agreement does not consider other bills that may be going through the legislature. And so, you know, it would have to be a conversation about whether those bills represent a change of terms and conditions within a bargaining unit and would be considered at a future date. I would say also there are conversations within those bills about incorporating adjustments into the rates for these particular services so that they're fully funded if there is a fiscal impact. So that work is currently being considered in the other body, I believe.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, President.
Thank you, Chair Noor. My question is, I understand the ask. I've spent the last 40 years in healthcare, and I understand how important the PCAs are, and I heard this from many, and continue to hear it from many. What my bigger question will be for this committee is, you know, that it looks to me that it's initially going to 19, the wages will go to 19 currently, and then to 20 in the next period. And with PCAs being at one level of it, then it's going to tee up the question for a greater question, which is coming to this committee, too, for CNAs. PCAs are working in various entities at $19 and $20 an hour, which could be an assisted living, which 80% are funded by state money right now. And we also have nursing homes. So if they're at $19 and $20, the greater question is going to be, and I can see what it is in millions here, but I'm just doing math in my head. The greater landscape that this is going to be is what will we pay then people for the higher care settings when we are doing the higher complicated settings? What will that be? Because if we don't, this is going to be where everybody's going to go as a PCA. So we could have greater issues for the assisted living settings and the nursing homes in rural Minnesota, which is what I'm worried about, because it'll transfer staff accordingly to the lower care needs from the higher care needs if there's not a continuum that makes sense based on skill set responsibility. So I'm not questioning the merit, the fact that we need, it's just the mechanism of how we're going to sufficiently figure out that continuum, and that's going to be something that this committee, and I know Chair Noor, you know, understands and is committed to too. But that's my greater concern is the magnitude of numbers, the number of aging seniors we have for the state of Minnesota in the next 10 years is pretty significant, and so caring for young to old is a huge conversation. But I appreciate, you know, the initiative and just have concerns on how we're going to provide a scalable plan that will work for the state. So that is my concern. Thank you.
Erica Bill.
Chair Knorr and Representative, I think that's a really good consideration to think about the whole industry. I would say that these PCA folks that provide the care in the home aren't necessarily providing care to people who have lower needs. They're providing care to maybe, in some instances, kids who are on the CAC waiver, so that's a hospital level of care. And so there's a huge range of needs that these PCAs are playing critical roles in providing care. And so I do think this committee should kind of think about the whole entire long-term care industry, but I would say this particular service provides a really important service to folks that a lot of times have a really high level of need.
Thank you so much, Derek. That's something we will be considering because we need to not to compete against each other in the same industry,
yeah, right,
but to compete with the market that right now is pushing people to fast food and other places. So we have to provide competitive wages to across the board in the long-term care. Any further questions? Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it'd be nice if the committee was provided with a rolling table of how much of the, you know, budgeted area budget is, you know, in the bills that we have voted to pass out of here. And in there probably should be a column for the additional impact to some of the broader bills. You know, there's touching upon the leave and some of the other things would bump up some of the costs. So that way we have a feeling because it catches up on you. You know, 5-10 small bills actually add up to a fair amount of money. And then when we're talking priorities, and my understanding that this one's been in and out of quite a few committees, so it's moving on independent of our, or is it part of our omnibus? So it's going to be
this bill stays with us. It's within our jurisdiction at this point.
So it'll be part of our omnibus bill. It's not going to travel independently.
I can't promise anything because if we have time to process bills, we'll process as soon as we can. So this is ongoing discussion, but this bill is in our jurisdiction at this point.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I eagerly anticipate the table to help us better understand. When the budget numbers come out, then we can see where things land. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Fong. Any other member discussion? Without any closing remarks,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I want to say to the representative, quit picking on us aging seniors. but anyway, this bill is the ratifying the contract that was negotiated with MMB. That's what this bill does. It's part of the bigger concern of senior health care and health care for the disabled. But this bill is basically about ratifying in a negotiated contract with the state of Minnesota and the SEI union. And as I said earlier, this covers PCAs that are hired by the people, PCA choice. Also, the money, it covers the people that work for agencies that hire PCAs and send them out, and those are covered by this contract. The money is covered, covers those also. The increase covers those also. This bill going forward is basically, like I said, it's the ratification of the contract that was negotiated with the MMB.
Well, Senator, I just wanted to check with Director Bill. This also includes if we implement CFSS. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
So this bill is a contract that we're going to be ratifying and we'll be including in our bill as we get the numbers and everything else. And this is a great bill. I think taking care of those who take care of us is something we should all be thinking about. And with that, I renew my motion that House File 1695 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. Thank you, members.
The final bill with us today is House File 2516. Representative Hicks, please move the bill and proceed with the introduction. I also see you put A1 amendment.
There's actually two amendments, an A1 and an A2. I'd like to move both amendments, please.
All right, so first you've moved House File 2516 to be laid over for possible inclusion, and you move A1 amendment. If you can briefly state what A1 amendment is.
Yes, so this bill is the money part to the bill we just heard. So the A1 amendment provides the funding for the two MOUs that ratified Chair Nelson's bill. It also funds certain individual components of the contract. The amendment brings the bill into line with the cost outlines in the governor's proposal.
Yep, so for all those in favor of the A1 amendments, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment, A1 amendment is now adopted. To Representative Hicks, move the A2 amendment. If you can explain the A2 amendment.
The A2 amendment is a technical amendment from DHS to correctly adjust the current funding rate to reflect the new costs associated with the contract. It does not change the total cost and brings the bill into line with the costs outlined in the governor's proposal.
All those in favor of A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. The A2 amendment is now adopted. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. Really excited that we are hearing the two back-to-back. I think it helps with the confusion of these bills. As you all know, I have a deep background in human services, and I'm proud and excited to bring House File 2516, which funds the SEIU home care contract and the two related MOUs. We already walked through the details of the contract with Representative Nelson right before this, so I won't repeat those now. Unlike other public sector contract ratifications, these agreements require both ratification and new funding, as PCAs are not state employees. I want to thank Representative Nadeau and Davids for co-authoring this bill with me. There is broad bipartisan support on the need to improve our home care system and to address the workforce shortage that endangers so many of our elderly and people with disabilities. This bill provides historic investment in home care services for the elderly, children with disabilities, and adults with disabilities. Like Director Bailey spoke of, a lot of the individuals utilizing PCA home care may utilize, you know, ventilators, G-tubes, and have extensive needs, or they may have other needs. The agreements are forecasted in the governor's budget change page for costs of just under $303 million in the first biennium and about $491 million in the second biennium. These costs will ensure that the state's checkbook reflects our values of investing in our caregivers. The individual riders in the bill fund specific parts of the contract, including $50 million for the six-month retention bonuses. In addition to the contract, also provides a little over $1.6 million to cover the COVID temporary rate increase memorandum of understanding and $6.4 million for the memorandum of understanding related to the Federal Anti-Fraud Protection Program, or the EVV verification, which, just to be clear, is a requirement from the feds that we must abide to. Your packet should include the governor's HHS budget change pages that were described the costs in detail. And I want to highlight the worker retention components in lines 2.8 to 2.24 of the A2 amendment that we just adopted. While both the union and the state wanted to reward and retain experienced workers with wages above the minimum, finding a way to do that within the constraints of the system was difficult. And I and the union want to thank DHS staff, especially Ms. Bailey, for their dedication to finding a way to make this work. The cost of the wages increases for nearly 30,000 home care workers add up to the big numbers for the overall budget. But I really believe that investing in the caregiving workforce is essential to provide care for our elderly and people with disabilities, which deserves to be a major priority for our state. The people who care for our most vulnerable deserve to be paid a fair wage. Their career choice matters, and it is a career. Caring for others is vital to our communities. If the home and community-based service system fails, the recipients of services do not disappear. They end up in more costly services, like the representative was talking about earlier. People have the right to live in community with the supports they need. And this bill is one piece of a bigger puzzle that this committee is tackling to support those goals. With that, I will open up for
we have
testifiers.
One testifier who signed up, Mr. Bajoran. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Matthew Bergeron, the law firm of Larkin Hoffman, here today on behalf of the Minnesota First Provider Alliance. The Provider Alliance is the statewide association of PCA agencies in the state of Minnesota. And I just want to thank Representative Hicks for working so closely with us as we've worked on this legislation and had conversations about the collective bargaining agreement more totally. First, let me start by saying that the Minnesota First Provider Alliance is very supportive of the collective bargaining agreement and the proposal you heard previously. It is a program that has been historically forgotten and underfunded, and workers who have not had the support from the state necessary to recognize the value of the work they're doing. And so we're very excited about that. I'm here today to express some concerns with the process for calculating the fiscal note and the costs associated with the reimbursement rate. And so in the last number of years, the Provider Alliance has engaged in some very substantive conversations with the Department of Human Services, and I want to thank Director Bailey and others with the department for their openness and engagement in those conversations in recent years. But there's very significant concerns as to how each time one of these collective bargaining agreements has been ratified, the state has calculated what the Medicaid rate needs to go up in order to cover the costs of the wages that are agreed to in that collective bargaining agreement. And from the Provider Alliance's perspective, those reimbursements have lagged behind the actual cost of providing and paying the wages and benefits that are in the collective bargaining agreement. Just for example, over the last three biennia, the collective bargaining agreement has increased the minimum wage in the PCA choice program and related programs by $4.50 an hour, while the Medicaid reimbursement rate has gone up by a total of $2.52 an hour. And that disconnect has made it very difficult for PCA agencies to continue to provide those services. And the current contract before you today has a, over the course of 2 years, a $4.75 increase in the minimum wage and only a $4.33 increase in reimbursement. Our position has generally been that it costs a dollar to pay a dollar. And there are a couple of issues that we have identified, both in kind of identifying what the jump needs to be and the data that the department relies on in doing that, and then some calculations it does as far as discounting that that value, that increase necessary, based on an assumption about the relationship between wages and benefits and total reimbursement. And you have a letter in your package today that kind of lays that out in greater detail, so I'll spare you those, except to say that we're looking forward to continuing to work with the chair, members of the committee, Representative Hicks, and all those parties involved to make sure that we're able to honor the commitments being made and support the workers that are doing the important work in our community. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Celeste.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Representative Hicks. I just want to clarify, just because I want to make sure I understand this. Does this initiative fund all the PCA agencies, regardless of if they're a union contract or if they're nonprofit or whatever their status is? Is it a funding for everybody, or is this just?
Representative Hicks, so is this funding for the rate that we're setting up here for the traditional and the choice PCA?
Thank you so much for the question. This sets up the rate, period. So this is the rate. So I think it's important, like I said in my opening statements, there's two bills, right? There's the contract, which Representative Nelson just had, and then this is the funding component of the PCA program. I do want to speak a little bit to what our testifier shared. The methodology here is complex, and I will not pretend to understand all of the details. But I would just offer the department, if anyone has specific questions around that, to come in and discuss that. And I would also say that, you know, I want to make sure that we get this right. This is really, really important to me that we get this right. And I continue to talk to stakeholders and evaluate their concerns and listen. And I really think that we, as a committee, can find a solution that's workable.
Absolutely. I think to get that clarity forward, Ms. Zalesnikar, if you wanted to follow up. Yes, this is for whether you're traditional or choice, this is the setting of the payment for that. And if we move to CFSS, whether you're doing a budget model or agency model, this is the funding for the program for PCA entirely. Whether you are part of SEIU or non-SEIU, this is the funding for PCA. So do you have any follow-up?
Thank you, Chair Noren. Thank you, Representative Hicks. Sorry for my ignorance, but I just wanted to understand, because I know there's a variety of providers across the state, in greater Minnesota and in Metro. And so I just wanted to make sure I understood, and thank you for the clarification, Chair Noren and Representative Hicks. Thanks.
I know Representative Hicks brought up the question to get clarity from the agency in terms of the issues that were addressed by Mr. Button. I don't know if there's anyone who just wanted to address briefly. We will have more conversation on this. Because the numbers is what we'll be making decision on. This is the committee of jurisdiction in terms of what we do to ensure that there's fairness and we fund properly the PCA, whether the numbers that we got from MMB is correct or not, whether the provider groups who are from the First Provider Alliance, in terms of the funding, it's up to us to make sure that we do the right thing for all the groups who are going to be impacted by this funding.
And to be clear, the reason I made that statement is because I don't know that I'll be able to answer any of the complex technical questions. So if anybody had them while Director Bailey was here, I wanted to make sure you had the opportunity to ask them.
Representative Baker.
Yep. Yeah, I guess to that, Mr. Chair, I would like to have Ms. Bailey come down. I think this is one of the most important decisions we make is to make sure that not a single provider is going to be shorted about the promises we're going to make to the labor market and what we're going to do. They cannot absorb one penny of shortfall for what we have to do with our workforce. In fact, they need a little extra to be able to be a little more creative in their own world. So I know that we've got our fiscal guru now at the table. So I can't wait to hear to make sure this, how do we get this right? So again, what Mr. Bergeron said isn't going to happen, because I would be ashamed if we passed something knowing that we had it right and they told us later, you're 50 cents or short or you're whatever short. That we can't do that. So help us maybe understand that.
Chair Noren, Representative Baker, thanks for the opportunity to kind of describe the math behind it. I would say it is complex, so sorry if I lose you in how we estimate this. So the bargaining unit has about 29,000 workers across the state, and that's about 25% of the PCA workforce, so only a quarter of it. We have data on every single one of those workers and how much they make. And what's contained in the bargaining agreement is not an increase to everyone's wages, but is a floor. So what we do in the analysis is we look at how much are they being paid now, and how much is the bargaining agreement requiring the floor to be. And so say you're going from 15 to 19, if folks are currently making 20, which some do, in the math we don't assume anything going up for those folks. And so if you're thinking about doing the math on 29,000 people level on a statewide basis, that's how we calculate the math. But as Mr. Bergeron said, as when it comes to each individual PCA agency, if they only have workers that make $15 an hour and they're required to go up to 19, their individual experience might not be the same as how we calculated on the average for across the state. And so that's why you're kind of hearing that from some PCA agencies where they might be experiencing a different experience in their business versus somebody who, another agency who may be paying a variety of wages above the current floor. That is a different math than, say, if we had a PCA framework bill where we were changing cost components within those, within the methodology, and we're just assuming it goes up for every single person. That would be a different kind of math. So I would say that our math is right. We're calculating exactly what it would cost to bring every person up to the floor in the agreement. However, if this committee wanted to add more additional funding to ensure that on a individual one-on-one business situation that they can fully afford to bring those workers up, that would be conducive to being added to this bill if that were the choice of the author or the chair. I would also say that for workers, that 75% of PCAs who aren't part of the bargaining unit, they're not required to meet the conditions of the agreement. So while we're increasing the rates for everyone, traditional and choice, those PCA agencies aren't required to actually pay them the floor that's contained in the agreement. So there's another kind of caveat there that you should consider.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Ms. Bailey. Roughly, with the SEI contract and the non-SEI stuff, is that roughly? You said 75%. Was it 75-25? Roughly, is that?
Derek,
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, correct.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Chair, I guess again to my point, to make sure we don't shortchange the providers that are non-union, that you don't have as much information on those, right, as others, and your information on the our union members. We just have to make sure, and how would you suggest we make sure, I guess, is maybe my question, so we don't short them. Do you have a, again, I think you just maybe mentioned, yeah, just put some more money in the bucket, I guess. With those providers, with having that available extra, we have to have some cushion here. We have to have, labor markets are changing quarterly right now, and so I think I want to make sure the state, in our grandiose wisdom of having so many employees that rely on our decisions here that are union or non-union, and we reimburse them accordingly, we have to make sure we get it right. So I don't even know where I'm going with this question, I guess, Mr. Chair, because I think it's so broad. It is complicated. I just think as our committee works through our structure and our targets, Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure we don't get it exactly right, because it won't be right. It just, we have to round up. We're going to have to give extra, and I say that this is where our efforts have to be on this. So, I guess thank you for just allowing me to kind of ramble a bit here, but it's really important that we talk about it openly in committee and understand the necessity to get this right. So again, thank you for that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any closing remarks from Derek?
Chair Nor, Representative Baker, I agree. So we'll work with the committee.
Thank you so much, Derek. Mr. Bergeron, I don't know if you wanted to add anything else. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of two things to kind of put in members' radar. One, Director Bailey gave the example of a PCA who's currently being paid $20 an hour that would be in the collective bargaining unit. I'll just note that the PCA reimbursement rate is $19.60. Therefore, if somebody's getting paid more than that or getting paid close to that, they're either working at a they're working at an entity that has other sources of revenue. They may be a 245D home and community-based services provider. They may be a Medicare home health agency. They may also be providing other services, or they may just be at an organization that is able to cost shift from one service delivery line to another in order to recruit workers in a tight workforce. So one of the concerns that the Provider Alliance has is that if you're not looking at from the floor to the floor, there's a disproportionate impact on small BIPOC-owned PCA-only agency providers in contrast to larger providers that might be also providing other programs and serving other populations at a higher reimbursement rate. The one other thing I'll note is we've had a lot of conversations across a variety of service lines about workforce shortage issues here. And so while it is all completely accurate to say that a traditional agency does not have to pay the wages and provide the benefits that are in the collective bargaining agreement, we also know that in a market where we've got tens of thousands of open positions, the traditional agencies are competing for those same workers. And so the BLS data, I think, shows out that the median wage is usually right along and tracks generally with the collective bargaining agreement. So those are just kind of the two other points I wanted to put on members' radar. So thank you.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Hicks, you weren't around when the SEIU labor contract, or when the PCAs joined in the union. You weren't around for that fight, I was. And it's been a couple of years since I've served on this committee. Could you refresh my mind now? Is the labor agreement that we heard in the previous bill and with your bill, is that a requirement that has to be funded? I honestly do not recall how it has worked in the past. Has there been a time when the funds, like this is what the labor agreement said, we're going to give them this X amount of dollars and it came in short? Or is this is what this committee has to fund? Does that make sense?
It does, and I will be completely honest. I have no idea. I assume that if we negotiate a contract, we have to fund it. I mean, that's just kind of my, like, common sense. Like, we don't say we're going to do something and then we don't fund it. But I don't know. I will phone a friend. Can anybody help me phone a friend? I'm so sorry. I don't know.
So I think, yeah.
Chair Dorr, Representative Franson, the agreement itself is contingent upon passage and appropriations. So if the committee or legislature did not fund it or did not pass the ratification, I believe we would have to go back to the table and renegotiate.
Okay.
Director Bell, while you're answering that question, so this is the flow. We can always go beyond what is already agreed to. I just wanted to put that on the record.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Representative Franson.
So then if the floor... So the floor is, but what? What is the floor here? I got so many papers here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, by the rate increase, do you mean?
Correct. What was negotiated?
What was negotiated is right now the current floor is $15.25, and on 1/1/24 it will be $19. On 1/1/25, it will be $20. And then there's experience tiers that will add to the rates that will go all the way up to $22.50 according to how long the particular worker has worked in the workforce.
Ms. Representative Franson.
I'm just trying to understand here. So if, let's say, the targets come in, right, and we've got all these needs and every issue that has come before us has been extremely important. So let's say there's not enough money to fund everything, and this particular program is shortchanged. So instead of it going to $19, now we're looking at, let's say, $18. Is that we're not allowed to do that, or I'm just trying to understand here.
Derek Abel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franson, what you would be agreeing to or appropriating the money for is the rate increase to the Medicaid service, not what was agreed to in the bargaining agreement. So I don't think what is on the table is modifying the particular components within the SEIU bargaining agreement.
Warrants conversations down the road.
So I'm assuming you're advocating for a higher wage.
Well, I actually, you know, we've had this issue before us for many, many years, and before it was, you know, we just want 4%, we want 5%, the 5% campaign. So I just want to make sure that we are also funding our nursing homes, which, and making sure that the PCAs, I live next to two group homes, so I know how hard those individuals work each and every day. I just want to make sure that if there are promises made to them with a contract, that we are able to keep those promises.
Promises made will be kept. At least we will be able to to fund the PCA. It's much needed. That's why we're hearing the two bills together in terms of the funding plus the contract, so that we do have the language before us. And yes, I will be asking you to be supporting funding across the board and paying for.
Well, let's see what the rest of the bill looks like.
Appreciate it. Any closing remarks, Representative?
I just want to say thank you, everyone, for hearing these bills and for your commitment to the full puzzle, right? I think, Representative Franson, you bring up the puzzle. And the puzzle is very, very, very complex, and there are lots of pieces, right? We've got our 245D providers, we've got our PCAs, we've got a lot of different pieces to this committee's puzzle. But as I stated in my opening remarks and as I've stated in this committee multiple times, the people who need services don't go away simply because we don't fund them in any pieces of that puzzle, right? We end up paying for them in different ways. It is very much a pay for it now or pay for it later model. If we do not pay for services and supports to keep people in community, people leave community. And when people leave community, they end up in more expensive services or stuck in hospitals. And so I hope that we can all work together and get make sure that the state of Minnesota's checkbook reflects our values. And so I'm looking forward to those conversations and the putting the puzzle pieces together with all of you. So thank you so much.
With that, Representative Hicks renews her motion that House File 2516 as amended to be laid over. The bill is laid over. Members, we don't have any further agenda items. We are now adjourned.